Hello and welcome to episode 27 of the Thundercast. On today's show, we're going to be talking about a few of the games that we've been playing recently. I'm Matthew Sorry, and joining me today, I have Shane Ryan.
Now then.
Okay, Shane, so in honour of the Steam sales beginning, everyone will clearly have been picking up some great buys, some very cheap purchases, so we thought we'd do an episode where we talk about what we've been playing recently. So I suppose I'll kick things off by talking about what I got in the Steam sale. I picked up Civilization V, which I haven't actually had time to play yet. I also picked up Supreme Commander, Supreme Commander 2, and Dark Souls, games which I used to own on Steam, but haven't actually played for a while. I used to own them off Steam, the original Supreme Commander, so I thought I'd pick that up again. How about you, Shane? What have you bought?
Bits and pieces. What did I pick up? Super Hexagon I picked up because that was dirt cheap. I think it was like 75% off, so it's next to nothing. Receiver, I think I had like 30 or 40% off. Mm-hmm. I got Dark Souls in the 75% flash sale. Natural Selection 2, Rome Total War, I got that. What else? I'm sure there's more than that. System Shock 2, The Swapper, that Surgeon Simulator. I'm just reading off the list on my PC at the moment. Sonic All-Stars Racing Transform, Psychonauts.
Wow, you're quite a collection you picked up.
Mark of the Ninja, and Chivalry, Medieval War, Fair, Antichamber, Max Payne 1 and 2.
Oh my, you've gone all out, Shane.
Yeah, I have. Well, I've got this PC this year, because I've been out PC gaming for a while, from when my last PC broke, and that was, what was I playing then? The first Far Cry, so that's how long it's been. It's been a while.
Mm-hmm.
So
you want to make the most of it?
Yeah, exactly. Steam's quite easy. It is easy to use. And Game had a trade-in offer. It's an extra 25% off. Well, 25% when you trade stuff in towards Steam credit. Mm-hmm. So I pretty much took 90% of my 360 game collection down and traded it in.
Trade it in for a PC collection.
Yeah, so I've now got a bunch of games and 170 quid credit, which will last me a while.
Yeah, that definitely will last you a while. So have you tried any of those games yet?
I was playing Super Hexagon before, which is great.
One of the most addicting games I have ever played.
I had to stop playing it because I couldn't track anymore of my eyes.
Yeah.
So for anyone that hasn't played it, Super Hexagon is a very quick... It uses like the current kind of old school but current platforming method where you don't have lives or anything. It's just you go, you die, you go. You just press A and keep jumping back in over and over again. So you kind of, there's a hexagon in the middle and this kind of a single colour background. And you're like an arrow that kind of just basically circles around the outside of the hexagon. And then there's just walls come in of like kind of shapes. Yeah. And then you've just got to try and always get in the gaps of everything. And then it speeds
barriers
up.
You need to avoid.
And it starts on the first difficulty is hard.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think sums it up really.
Yeah,
it's very difficult. So when you first start playing it, you last about 5 seconds ago, and you start building it up. And I think I'm on hard setting. I think I'm up to 45 seconds now. Mm-hmm. It's bloody hard.
The settings go, what is it, something ridiculous, like hardest. I'm sure they get ridiculous.
Yeah, you can unlock them after that, but not by that far. So. Yeah, Super Hexagon's really good. I mean, the Steam sale will be over by the time people hear this, but I hope people have picked it up that haven't. And even if you haven't, I think it's about £1.99.
Mm-hmm.
It's a cheap enough title, so if you like that sort of quick arcade thing, and although it's quick arcade, it's only like 30 seconds ago. Half an hour passes in no time.
Yeah, definitely. It's one of the most addicting games. I mean, I've got it on my iPhone, and I find it's one of those games that I just pull out. If you're stopping somewhere for 5 minutes, sat at the bus stop, it's one of those games that you pull out and just try and play for 5 minutes and try and get a little bit better at. It's one of those games that challenges you to beat your own score or something. So it's addictive in that sense, trying to train yourself to become better at it.
Mm-hmm. It reminds me a lot of Super Meat Boy. That sort of, it's got the same sensibility of that. It's really difficult, but you just keep going and going and going and going, and you get better over time. You actually have a skill arc rather than the game just being the same throughout.
You can tell that you're getting better and you get better, and there's more challenges further down the line. Mm-hmm. It gets more difficult as you get better. I don't think I've ever... I got to 60 seconds, I think, on the first level hard, and I think that's my best run, which like pales in comparison to some of the ridiculously good people you can find on YouTube. Very good game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll try and beat that then soon. Although I've got so much to play now, my Steam catalog is just ludicrous. There's games I haven't booted up yet, and I'm buying new ones.
It is. Steam has that effect, and especially the Steam sales have that effect, where you see something for £3 when it was £20, and you think that's too good not to buy.
You can't afford not to.
Exactly, yeah, can't afford not to, but in all likelihood, you might have the money, but you don't have the hours to put into it or to play it.
It's definitely true. I mean, I'm finding less time to play games than ever before, and I've got stackfuls. Although, the filtering on Steam's pretty poor, so at the moment I've just got games and favourites in the list, and I just star stuff I haven't completed yet. So that list is long.
You've got a work list.
I have.
Games to get through. You bought them, you got to get through them.
So that was, that's really good, Super Hexagon. Definitely recommended. What about yourself? Do you want to pick one?
Yeah, well, I've just been playing a lot of Dark Souls and a lot of Supreme Commander 2. So, like I said, I used to have Dark Souls on my 360, and I used to have Supreme Commander 2 on my old PC, not on Steam.
Mm-hmm.
So I fancy picking them up again, and these games, these are my, like, addictive games, so... They're the kind of games where I pick them up again and instantly I'm addicted straight away, and I really just want to play more and more of them and not do anything else. And it's not very good for my productivity, I feel.
So I want to hear about Supreme Commander more, but Dark Souls starting again, how does it feel?
It feels pretty good because, again, this is the kind of game where I think you learn how to play it and you become better at it. And once you do... It's not quite as difficult because the first time anyone plays Dark Souls or the first time anyone played Demon Souls had that instant kind of like, shit, this is too difficult to play. I can't do this. Mm-hmm. It's ridiculous. Like, one of the first things you come across in Dark Souls is an incredibly overpowered boss that you can't defeat. You have to run around it. You could if you were very good, but it's very difficult.
Yeah, like 1% of people can do it straight away. Most people run.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's the whole point of it. But going back to it now, I picked it up straight. It's kind of like riding a bike in a way. It's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. It sounds a bit ridiculous. But you pick up the rhythm of the game and the rhythm of the combat. It's very rhythmic, the combat. It's about balancing your defense and then your attack and when you do it and watching enemy animations. And if you already know that, then the game is quite a bit easier. So I've been running through it quite well. I haven't been finding it too difficult, but I don't want to get cocky because I'm sure I will at some point.
Did you? You completed it originally, didn't you?
Well... No, I had this thing.
Oh, it was the save thing, wasn't it?
Yeah, the save file corrupted on my 360 version as I was getting towards the end of the game, which was.
I bet you lost your temper about that.
Things. Yeah. I don't think I've. Like, I'm not the kind of person who throws a controller across the room, but I think I might have then. But, so I picked up Dark Souls, been playing a lot of Dark Souls, and it's just an addictive rhythm. I generally enjoy games for storytelling and the way that they can tell stories, and most games I don't play on hard difficulty settings. I play on normal or easy because I generally just want to experience the game.
Yeah.
But Dark Souls is one of those few games where I really like, you don't have a choice but to play it on, it doesn't have any difficulty settings, you just play it as it is. But it's one of those games where the challenge is addictive. Because of the way that the challenge is set up, you are learning, you are becoming better, and that's how you progress. And you lose things when you die, but the way that the open world is set up with the checkpoints dotted throughout it, you don't go right back to the start. It's kind of a roguelike in a sense, but you have the opportunity to get those things that you lost back.
Mm-hmm.
If you reach the area where you died. So that kind of, it gives an addictive quality. You die in one area and you don't go right back to the start. You just get set back a little bit and you feel like, right, well, I know what I need to do there now. And there's a chance that if I get back to that area, I can pick up all that stuff that I've lost, pick up all those souls that I've lost and all the humanity that I've lost. And I can complete that section as well. And it's a rare kind of design that most games don't have. It's quite unique.
I think it's because it's so hard to do. I think... When you mentioned before about the difficulty of this game and enjoying it, I think that's because it's like Super Hexagon, again, it's a game that requires an actual building of skill. It's like riding the bike thing. You're right, because with a lot of games, and this is part of the reason why I stopped playing on my 360 as much, is like Halo 4, played it for an hour and went, I'm done with this. I've played this 100 times. I have played this game so many times. I'm just killing everything. I've got no interest in it. I'm done with this. Mm-hmm. And I just stopped playing it. And I feel that a lot of games have removed the skill level, basically. Mm-hmm. So difficulty levels are usually just, oh, you turn up to hard and everyone does twice as much damage. It's just like modifiers. There's no design background to it.
Yeah.
And with something like Dark Souls, it is a skill. It is built to be around the idea of you have to learn to play it.
It's intrinsically, it's part of the game experience, and the game's been designed around that, and it makes sense.
Which is not an easy thing to do, because it could easily fail.
Exactly. And it's a crazy thing. Like, there's such a reward when you do actually overcome that thing, when you do overcome that ridiculous boss battle that was just impossible a few minutes ago. When you do overcome it, then it's such, you get lots of rewards in-game, but there's such a sense of reward as well to yourself, to the player, that's quite unlike many other games.
I'd actually say that with the reward part, when I played it, from what I recall, it was sometimes it wasn't even that good in the reality of what your stats do, because you have all this stats system, but I'm quite positive that most of that doesn't really build into your skill. Like a lot of RPGs, it's just you go into a room, if your stats are too low, you can't do it. You're just screwed every time. But in this, it's not quite like that. It's your actual personal skill can come in. That's why you get those speed runs of the game.
Yeah, yeah. And it is a weird mixture. The stats, they do blend into it in a sense. I know what you mean, because a lot of the start of the game, a lot of the early game, doesn't really feel like your stats are doing much if you're improving them. Because you earn souls by killing the demons and monsters that you kill throughout the game. And you can spend those souls on many different things, but the main thing is leveling your character up. And your character has a number of attributes, a number of areas where you can level them up. There's things like strength, dexterity, endurance, vitality, things like that. And it's really, really deep, and it's really, really hard to fathom when you begin with. But if you know what you're doing, this is like anything with Dark Souls, if you know what you're doing and you know what kind of build you want to go for, then you can start from, because you choose a character to begin with that has certain points and certain skill level at different things. But you can build up any kind of character you want from what you start with, because you can choose to put those points into any skill, into any attribute. So it's kind of, it does build into it eventually, but I say the early game, it doesn't really affect it that much. But when you get to the end game, if you've customized your character, like if you've got a very much endurance and dexterity based character, then you can kind of choose weapons that suit that kind of character. And you'll be more powerful if you engineer your character towards a certain play style, if you get what I mean.
Another thing I'd like to quick mention is the atmosphere to the game. And when I think to so many people wanting to, like Capcom to go back, asking Capcom sort of, you know, what's happened, where did the magic of Resident Evil 1 and 2 go? Where did the atmosphere go? And it's quite obvious that From Software stole it. Because Dark Souls, on a purely atmospheric kind of, you play through it and you, to say drone sounds like you're not paying attention, and that's not the case, but it's that warming kind of eerie sensation where you just kind of
get into the mood. It's medieval fantasy. It's very much medieval fantasy, but it's medieval fantasy interpreted by, it feels like someone who maybe didn't quite understand it, and it's quite different take on medieval fantasy. It's not, there's dragons in there and there's monsters and things like that, and you're playing as a knight and you wear armor and things like that. But none of it is very explained, and there's always a slightly weird twist on those elements.
Yeah.
So like you might have a big dragon monster, but like its entire body is made of teeth on the underside, and it's pretty strange. And Dark Souls never really explains very much to you. You have to go and figure it out for yourself just by testing its limits. Which is very different. Something like, I was just playing Dragon's Dogma recently, actually. I thought I'd pick that up on PlayStation.
Yeah, I've heard quite a bit about that.
I think it might have been free. No, maybe it wasn't free.
I've heard it's a slog at the beginning.
Yeah, and I just didn't find it very entertaining. The combat wasn't difficult in the sense of Dark Souls. It didn't feel like you could learn how to overcome it. It didn't feel like there was a skill in overcoming it. It felt like it would just be a slog. And you just have to get through it. And there wasn't very much entertaining about that. And it it didn't quite nail that sense that Dark Souls has. Dark Souls feels very distant, and for some reason that's quite enticing. You feel like you want to go and explore that. Something like Dragon's Dogma, where it feels very explicit, like, oh, here is this, this is what this is, this is what this land is called, this is what this area is called, this is what this person's called, this is the backstory. Dark Souls, it's all there, but it's all in the background for you to go and find out.
Yeah, it's
and
all when, in the distance, you have to go and actually walk towards it and find it.
Exactly, yeah, and you will... And you'll stumble across things, and when you stumble across something in Dark Souls, like it's just the weirdest moment. Like you might you end up going underground in certain areas of Dark Souls, and you might turn a random corner that is off the beaten path somewhere, and you'll hit the wall, and oh, actually, there's a hidden wall there, and you'll go through it, and there'll be a gigantic other area that you didn't even know was there, and that you would never have gone to if you hadn't just explored the game's limits and just gone out of your way to experiment a little bit and go off the beaten path. And that's very rare. That's something you don't get in game design so much these days. That feels, it feels unique. Yeah. So have you played Dark Souls? You said you picked it up.
Yep. Well, I've played it back on the 360. But with the, because I mentioned before, I traded some stuff in, and it actually, because it was 75% off, I bought it, and then went and traded my 360 copy in, and ended up making a credit profit there. but there's been an update to Steam yesterday or today that's causing it to crash. So I'm just waiting for that to get fixed, and then I'll get playing it. Soon to do games for Windows booting up. So I've to wait until that's fixed. But yeah, I'll definitely stop playing. I never completed it the first time. So I definitely will be putting some time aside to play it.
If you need any help, I'm not saying I'm the ultimate expert, but...
I'll give it a go again.
Yeah. Cool. So have you been playing anything else from your Steam sale purchases?
Yes. I've been attempting to play Natural Selection 2, but it's not doing anything for me yet.
Okay.
So Natural Selection 2 is a first-person shooter. It's team-based. It's supposed to be quite niche, quite difficult to get into, which, again, kind of sounded intriguing. I had quite a few difficulties just getting it to run right for some reason. It sounds like I'm not selling PC gaming here, but these are like just two examples. Everything else has been running fine. But this, it's started playing it, tried to get into the tutorials, went through all that. Quite difficult getting into a game, got into a game, and then there's only two people on each side. It just didn't work. I don't know if maybe it's more of a US fan base for it or not, but when I was playing it, it was quite hard to get a game. And so, I just started playing it, and I just wasn't...
So is it not that it's got quite a large community, but you just can't connect to it very well?
No, I don't think it has anymore. I was hoping because the Steam sale that picked it up, and it would get a bit of a boost. So there's Marines and Aliens, and it's like half first person shooter, half real time strategy. So there's kind of base building and other things going on, and there's one commander on each team that oversees the map and helps out. So it's a blend of those elements. So it's half strategy, half skill. I'm going to try and jump back into it again, but it felt, even when I was in the game, it felt quite dry, which I presume was why it's been given a kind of a niche title, because on the surface it doesn't seem much, but there's more to it as you dig in. But I'm guessing the difficulty is trying to get through that layer, trying to get a bit deeper into it.
Can you play as the alien creatures?
Yes, you can, yeah.
And is that, I'm guessing that's different gameplay, or do they just use weapons like the humans?
No, it's totally different.
All right.
So you start off as kind of like a little grunt thing that's basically a giant mouth on legs that can run up the walls and stuff.
Okay. Does that feel different? Because I kind of like multiplayer. I think it's quite interesting when you have a multiplayer game that has two sides, competitive game that has two sides, but those sides are different in the way that they play and the way that you experience those sides.
I've not played it enough to say. The way it's set up suggests so, but I don't know whether there is this, because you can have a balance between teams, or you can have it kind of homogenized and overbalanced where they have different weapons, but essentially it's the same.
Yeah.
I mean, on the surface, from what I've seen, these is totally different, but I don't know how it's balanced, or whether the balance is just if it's run through. Yeah, you've got a gun, but it does less damage because here's a melee attack that does more. Yeah. Or whether they play completely differently. So I'm going to try and get back into it soon. I just need to find the time to do that. I've also been playing a game that I've been keeping an eye on, and so it went in the sale, so I picked it up, called Receiver.
Okay.
So this was in... I'm trying to recall exactly what I think it was a 48-hour or 72-hour kind of game competition where you had to build a game or a first-person shooter in basically a weekend. It's one of those kind of coding jams, I think.
Yeah.
So I think it's made by a few people, and it's very basic looking. It looks kind of like Cairo in the sense that it's it looks kind of cheap and blocky.
Yeah.
But it does what it needs to do. Mm-hmm. But at the core of it is basically gunplay. So it's all about the guns. So you randomly start. It's basically like a futuristic apartment block, and you randomly start within it.
Mm-hmm.
And there is, I think, three different pistols you can start with. And sometimes you have a flashlight. And what you have to do is you have to try and find these 11 tapes that fill in the backstory as to why you're there. And as you're going around, there's kind of security turrets and security kind of hovering cameras. And if you get hit once, you're dead. And you start all over again. And you randomly spawn.
So this is very much a skill-based game as well.
Yeah, yes. And it's almost like a survival horror with a sci-fi theme, but very low budget because it's one-hit kills. It's got a weird atmosphere, kind of same sort of atmosphere to it. But what's really good about it is you can basically take the gun. You do everything with the gun. So you don't just press reload and that's it. You can take the clip out. You can manually put bullets in if you've only got one clip, or you can get another clip and stock up. You have to pull the clip back. You have to take the safety off. You can
take the
round out of the chamber.
So it's super detailed.
Yeah, and that's the main idea is it's all that. So the gun hovers in front as if it is actually at arm's length. And when you kind of let go of the aim button, it brings it down. There's no actual arm modelled in because, again, it was a weekend thing. But if it was, it would look as if, like in the darkness, where it's actually not full body awareness because it's not moving around, but you've actually got a proper perspective rather than it being glued to the wrist, like really weird angles. So it's kind of held out. And there's something really satisfying about pulling back the chamber, or when you've got like this, the revolver is flicking it out and having the six bullet chamber and putting the rounds in and flicking it back and pulling the and you have to actually open it up and kind of shake it so the bullets come out. But you can't do it in a fashion where only the ones you want to come out, so you have to do it all, load it back up, and then pick the spares up off the floor. It's really hard. So far, I've only got 5 out of the 11. Took me about 15 minutes, and I just got hit by something. I was like, oh. So it's really difficult, but there's just such a satisfaction in the way the guns work. It just makes me think, if another game, like, maybe not even a fast-paced one, or some sort of first-person shooter, or maybe even a story-based game, but had the pace, like, Condemned, but it had that attention to detail on the guns, would be great. So that's really cheap. Again, it's a couple of pound.
Okay.
If it sounds interesting in the slightest, then you really should go pick it up. It's, you know, aesthetically, it's really dry in how it looks. But just the kind of feel of the way it plays, and the focus on kind of a core concept where it's not, we need to make everything look great. So let's spend less time on this core idea. It's no, the core idea is key. Everything else suffers. Which is, again, something that doesn't really happen because in bigger budget games, everything has to be an acceptable level. So you can lose focus on some kind of key ideas, which I guess on a side note, and now looking back on it, is where Bioshock Infinite didn't hit the higher peaks that it should have because it was held back by some just generalized work rather than kind of stick to the key ideas, which is probably why when we look back on the older demos, some of the stuff went missing this time on. But Receiver, it's just this one key core idea, which is the gunplay and how it works.
I think there's something to be said for a game that just focuses on one single thing, doesn't care too much about the periphery of that, but really nails that one thing and nails the feeling of that one thing
and
becomes addictive because of that.
Yeah, so that's been great playing that.
Okay, very good. Okay, then, should we take a short break here? And we'll be back talking about more games that we have been playing recently.
We'll be right back.
Shane, we've talked about a lot of games that are difficult. They're very much skill-based games. We talked about why we like them because of that. But changing speeds a little bit, changing gears. I want to talk about a game that I've been playing recently called The Last Door, which is this point-and-click puzzle adventure. It's developed by a Spanish game studio called The Game Kitchen, and it's developed on the back of a successful Kickstarter campaign. It was very modest. I think they only asked for a few £1,000 to develop it. And it's a very modest game as well, but I'm quite enjoying it. It's a horror game. It's kind of set in 19th century, kind of pre-Edwardian England. You play as a guy called Jeremiah DeWitt, who goes round to his friend's mansion after his friend has committed suicide. It's got this really interesting opening scene where you're playing as this guy opens in an attic, and really sad music in the background, and there's like an opening line of a letter shows up on screen, says something like, "All these things I have done," and then it opens onto this image of the attic and a person in there, and there's a little weird shape on the middle of the floor. It's a very pixelated game, very pixel art game, so it's kind of hard to make out what things are sometimes, but there's a shape of something brown on the floor and another brown shape slightly darker next to it. Then you walk around this attic scene, you can try and click on things, but you find out that the only things that are interactive in this scene are the two brown shapes on the floor, and one of them turns out to be a chair and the other one turns out to be a rope. And after you click on the chair and the rope, you get another line from this letter, and you realize it's a suicide letter, and the only thing that you can do in this room is to make this guy commit suicide. And I just thought it's a really nice opening. It's a really nice way to set the tone of the game to come, and it's a really nice demonstration of how a lack of choice in games can often be as interesting as choice in games, because we often think of games, they're interactive entertainment. You can make choices in these games. Something like The Walking Dead is a really good example of how you can make choices in games and it affects narrative. And we often focus on that and are slightly blinded to what we can do with a lack of interactivity as well. So the fact that you didn't have a choice in this situation kind of, I don't know, it felt like something. It felt like you were forcing this guy to do something, to commit suicide, but you weren't.
I did just enjoy your use of the word nice three times in the description of the fact that you are forced to commit suicide as a character. Yeah. But I know what you mean, because it's...
I suppose it's nice because it's different in a way.
Yeah, I know what you mean. But that is... I'm trying to think of anything even close to that.
It's quite harrowing.
It's hard enough trying to think of a game where you play a character that dies. The Modern Warfare series took that to the extreme, where it became kind of a cliche of the fact that it was just on purposely.
Yeah, and it didn't come to mean anything. But yeah. This opening scene was impactful, and it really set the tone of the game straight away. It was a sledgehammer opening, and it was nice. No, it wasn't nice. It was awful, but like it was very engrossing, if you will.
Definitely, and I'm also on the note of decision making. I feel we're kind of a... With some titles, I think it's becoming a bit of a tick box. It will be in development, because remember, games take a few years and develop some. So anything that's come through Mass Effect, popularity, and going into The Walking Dead. Yeah. But I also don't think it's not a solution to a bad story.
No. The thing is, it's kind of like we're seeing a slight resurgence in black and white movies at the moment, and maybe silent movies as well. It's kind of like... just because you don't have choice in a game, that doesn't mean that it's bad. It's a creative decision by the designers, and if that means something, if they can use that to tell you something, then that's great. I think there's sometimes when you discover something new, and when games are really trying to explore the idea of choice in narratives at the moment, and I think when a medium starts exploring something different from a storytelling perspective, there's often a tendency to get blinded and have the blinkers on and just be focused on that one thing. But I thought that was a very nice example of how games can be affecting from a storytelling perspective when they draw choice away, but they make you do something because they're interactive. You have to do something, but you have no choice about what you do. Yeah, so that was a very great opening. And from there, you end up playing as, this guy called Jeremiah DeWitt, who is the friend of this chap. They're old school friends, and he comes around to his mansion. He finds it's deserted, and he wants to figure out what's going on here. It's a very, very strange opening moment where you walk up to the mansion, and because the game is very pixelated, it's very much a pixel art game. Some people might think it looks cheaply made. I would say the visual design It's very blocky, very pixely, but I would say the visual design actually adds to the atmosphere of the game because some things are slightly unclear.
It's like in films, the less you see, the scarier stuff is. When they show you the ghost, it's not scary anymore.
Yeah, and sometimes if you can't quite make out what something is or if something's slightly unclear, it makes you imagine worse things, if you will. So you walk up to the mansion as this guy and you see like this collection of black pixels moving around, red pixels moving around them. You can't really tell what it is to begin with, but you might move over to it and you'll notice it's a murder of crows, a group of crows eating something on the floor outside of his mansion. And it's just kind of a weird thing to walk up to, and I found that I didn't know what that was at first. I couldn't tell what it was, but when I figured out what it was, it's like, oh, right, okay, that's a bit weird and creepy. but the first chapter that you can play, this is kind of a chapter-based game, kind of like The Walking Dead. They're going to be released separately. The first chapter you play is all set in this guy's mansion, and you figuring out what went on in this mansion, and that kind of hints at a larger narrative. And the second chapter that's been released so far, you go to the school that you and this chap who's committed suicide went to and try and figure out there's some history there, some backstory that can explain something about why this guy committed suicide. And I like the way that the story progresses throughout each of these chapters. The first one's about half an hour, the second one's about an hour long. Each one, they're point-and-click, puzzle-based games, so they're very much an old-school kind of game, kind of in the vein of something like King's Quest or Steel Sky.
The old Sierra ones.
yeah, exactly, just like them. So it's find item, try and figure out where you can use that item in the environment to progress the story, to move something on. And the first chapter, it's quite interesting. You kind of get little story bits every time you solve a puzzle. You unlock a room and maybe that'll hint at something else. And that kind of goes on until you eventually, well, what's more, the end of it.
So is there any threat to the character? Is it purely a action puzzle point and click?
No, there's no real threat, but I'm not sure after having finished the second one. I don't want to give too much away for anyone who's going to play it. But no, it's an action thing, but it's definitely got a weird kind of Lovecraftian vibe, if you will.
Yeah, sounds like it. Sounds like Alone in the Dark, the original.
Yes, something like that, yeah, very much like that. That's quite a good comparison, actually. So you're going through these creepy old mansions, it's quite dark. The first one doesn't have any people in it, or should I say any live people. The second one, you can tell that they've improved their tech maybe a little bit, and they've experimented a bit more. The second one has people in it, you can have conversations in the second one with these people. conversations with the people, and the second one's a little more detailed in a way that the puzzles are more complicated. One thing of note is this is being released as chapters, and like I said before, it's crowdfunded, and you can make donations if you want to pay for these games. You can play the first two for free, but you can choose to donate a small amount of money if you want to help fund the development of the future chapters. And the best thing I could say about it probably is that I think it's definitely worth a donation, because we don't see these type of games anymore, and for this type of game, it's a very good one. It's very interesting. The story is still very intriguing, and some of the moments that happen through the game, it has quite a few moments like that suicide moment, like the opening suicide scene, that are just kind of shocking instant instances that you weren't expecting and that make you do something that you weren't quite, or that maybe you didn't want to do. And it's very interesting for that, I think.
So what's that called again?
It's called The Last Door. You can go to thelastdoor.com and check it out.
Okay.
First chapter for free.
Sounds all right. Going back to the kind of art style, is the pixelated ever a negative, or does it always, or is there kind of like a consistent use of the way?
It's very consistent.
The abstract way you can't see stuff, yeah.
Yeah, no, it's very consistent. I can see a lot of people being down in it, and I think I read a lot of comments maybe on the Kickstarter page. A lot of people were quite negative about it because they think that the graphics look cheaply made. I didn't find them to be a problem throughout playing it. I thought they worked perfectly for what the game is. I never thought, oh, more detail here. I don't. It might be flash based. Yeah, it plays in
a browser,
in the Internet Explorer. Yeah, okay. I never found myself thinking, well, if this was higher resolution, if I could see more, it would be 10 times better. No, it didn't. It wasn't negative. It wasn't derogatory. It didn't take anything away from the experience, I don't think.
Okay.
So yeah, definitely want to check out The Last Door. Independently developed title, independent spirit, and a very interesting game.
So I will, on the back of that, follow up with something similar in art style, which is Cart Life.
Okay.
Not played a lot of this, which seems to be a running theme of this episode. So there's so much to play. I'm just dipping my toes into the waters of a few games, seeing what they're like. Mm-hmm. So Cart Life is... I heard about this on another podcast I was listening to and thought, that sounds laborious, but I'm interested because of the kind of the idea behind it. So Cart Life is a black and white, monochrome kind of 8-16-bit looking thing. When people talk, it sounds like an old fax machine churning away. All text-based, really, and you pick... there's a few different characters. I believe it's... you can get a free copy of it on the website, but on Steam, it's the paid-for one, which has more characters or something along those lines. And there's kind of a woman who's just maybe, I think, got divorced with a kid, and she's staying at a friend's house, and she wants to open a coffee shop. And there's like a guy that's come over from Eastern Europe, and he wants to kind of work. And you essentially have next to nothing. Mm-hmm. And as soon as you start, there's a timer which counts down each day. And then you've just got to micromanage your expenses. But the game, it looks to be set out for you to pretty much fail. Or at least really struggle.
Yeah.
And it also makes you do the tasks that you're doing as part of kind of some bizarre mini game. Mm-hmm. But there's no real fun anywhere in a conventional sense, which is interesting in itself. As you probably guessed, it's an indie game, and that's why it's this idea. But I haven't gone back to it yet, only for the reason that to work all day and then come home and then work in a game.
A game that is... I've played quite a bit of Cart Life myself. It is a life simulator, and it is a work simulator. And it's kind of... it's an art... I wouldn't say it's an art game in a sense, because it's not a game made for entertainment. It's a game made to make a statement and made to make you think about something. It's made to make you think about life and how hard things are. And it puts you in the shoes of these people who own carts, and you have to set up your own cart. Who have difficult lives and difficult situations, and it makes you think about that kind of circumstance.
But
so
if you're
finding it hard, you don't really find it that enjoyable to play.
No, and the sound design I don't like because of that kind of... it's the style of it. It's supposed to be old, kind of retro. I'll definitely go back and give it a try. It's just... I mean, if we got paid to write and play video games all day, every day, then it would probably be different. But to do a job and then to come back and play the job sort of thing, it's just like... Now, I understand the point, and it's full credit for them to doing that. And the reason I want to go back and play it, even though it's not fun, is I'm a strong believer that just because something isn't fun as a video game does not make it not worthwhile in any way. Too many people
totally agree.
Treat video games like cars. So it's kind of like, oh, does it drive faster than the other one? Does it look nicer? All right, okay, I prefer that one. Without any, it's very mechanical and cold without any...
yes.
Like you said, the word is art, pretty much. And art is just the kind of emotional reaction to something. So the fact we're having this conversation means that the game's worked in that sense. And the fact that I don't really want to go back and play it because it's too laborious is the point.
Yeah, it's kind of illustrated its point to you, and it's clearly been effective.
So perhaps the fact I don't want to play it compared to somebody else played it means that maybe it's worked better. I mean, I'll go back and I'll dig deeper into it. I mean, I didn't play much of it. I think I really need to sit down with a couple of hours and just focus completely on that without distraction.
I mean, it kind of... the existence of games like this these days feeds into the discussion about games as a medium and what they're about and what they can be about. So clearly most video games are made for entertainment. They're made to shock you, made to thrill you, made to engross you, made to put you in these fantastical worlds that you can't be in. Most of them are power fantasies, they're power trips. But games can also be an expressive medium. They can be a medium for the expression of ideas or the examination of systems like Cart Life is. But they're the minority at the moment. You don't get that many games that are about that. It's generally independent games made by people that don't make too much money because they're not as commercially successful as the common type of entertainment video game. But I love that we have things like this coming through that really show what can be done with the medium. That's why I called it an art game, because it is the expression of an idea. It's the expression of emotions and ideas. It's trying to convey something, an experience that... It's trying to give you an experience to make you think about something, not just to entertain you.
To me, this is... these sort of games are... I don't like using the example of cinema, but there's a lot of things at the moment where everything's got to be cinematic.
Yeah.
And I don't want things to be cinematic because, you know, it's like... I don't want a film to be really like a... I don't want it to try... I don't want, you know, like cinema to try and be like a book, because it won't make sense. I want each thing to be its own and look at these things. But at the same time, this feels... these sort of games feel closer to the heart of cinema than big triple-A budget... cinematic just means big and flashy, big production, but cinema's not about that. Cinema is about an idea, a concept. You know, films, people make films that aren't meant to be fun, but it's supposed to have a story and a message and a purpose. And I feel like this stuff is closer to the heart of cinema than like Bioshock Infinite is, which isn't. It's just because it's got a big script and it's, you know, well produced doesn't make it cinematic. This is... there's a difference, and I feel like these things are closer to those ideas.
I know exactly what you mean, and I think part of that stems from the fact that cinema as a medium, film as a medium, it's got more of a balance. Like, probably most films are made for entertainment, but there's more of a balance between the films that are made for entertainment and the films that are made as expressions of ideas and to make you think about things that aren't just pure entertainment. And I don't think that games has that balance yet. And if you look at the early forms of film and the early the beginnings of most mediums, really, mostly they start out as areas to entertain, but people come up with ideas and ways to use them as an expressive medium, a personally expressive medium or a socially expressive medium, something like that. So I love that we have the emergence of this type of game. It actually brings to mind another game that I played recently called Papers, Please.
Yeah, I really want to play that, but I'm waiting for the full version.
That is really good. Yeah. It's probably worth waiting for the full version, but that is really worth checking out. That is really good. It puts you in the shoes of a border patrol officer of a communist state, and the state imposes increasingly intrusive inspections that you need to carry on, and the people wanting to come into your country. And it's quite horrible, and it's the examination of a system, a real-life system, a real-world system in video game form. So it's not done necessarily for entertainment. It's made to put you in the shoes of that person and make you think about what it is to live that kind of life, to do that kind of job, what it's like, how hard it is.
Yeah.
And it really puts you in some awful situations, and it's really interesting. It's provocative.
I mean, recently I finally got around to playing Spec Ops The Line, and I absolutely loved the way that used video games to tell its story. So it wasn't, this is a script I can't get signed off by Hollywood that shoehorn this in. It was, I'm going to write something that means something. And it's one of the few games I've played where that the hair on my arms has stood on end one or two times, because there's some imagery in that which is like so powerful compared to even of, like, it's, again, compared to films or other literature. It stands on its own 2 feet. Now, mechanically, it's pretty standard. But so many people seem to just think, well, you know, it's a bit clunky, it's not as good as Gears of War, doesn't play as good, so, you know, shit. Well, you're missing the point, and that's just really disruptive to this, you know, any sort of real progress being made. And the way that, I mean, I'm not going to talk about story or anything, but the way it uses the fact that you interact with it, and I don't mean in a way of pick this, like, dialogue choice. It's kind of, it's much deeper than that. It's very, well, I guess the phrase kind of meta. It's within... it knows it's been the interaction it uses to tell the story, and the fact it gets your involvement, and then the fact you do things, and then when you realise what it actually means, and the way it turns around the fact that we would just blow away and, you know, just click on everything and do what we're told. And, you know, because really, video games, when you're doing it, if you think about what you're doing, you're just conforming to strict rules. You are told it's A to jump, and you just press A straight away. You don't press another button just to check. And that kind of uses that kind of always willingness to accept it to do other things within the game.
Totally. I actually played that myself recently, earlier on in the year, and I think the same as well. I think it's really interesting the way that it uses that. I think it's really interesting the way that Spec Ops like lots of games where you get given choices, you're presented with the choice, maybe in a text tree or something, mm-hmm. and you know it's a choice, and you know those moments, you're making that choice, and you can generally tell, oh, this is the good route, this is the evil route, this is what I want to do. What I liked about Spec Ops The Line was it put you in choice-based situations, but it didn't explicitly tell you, look, this is a choice. It left it open to you. And I think a lot of people, because you play video games, and like you said, you're given structures and systems and things to play within, but you can't go outside of those boundaries normally.
Hmm.
I think a lot of people will have been, maybe, I don't know, won't have known what to do at those points, or maybe...
yeah, because it doesn't just, tell they you will, that that's what's happening.
Yeah, they will have acted in a certain way. I think there's a point in Spec Ops where you can choose to kill certain people, but you mm-hmm. don't have to if you don't want to. You could leave them alone if you wanted to. But the game doesn't tell you that. But I think in most video games, you're taught, look, shoot everyone on screen. They're all enemies. Kill them and progress. That's how it works.
Yeah, or pop up or signal exactly what's happening.
Exactly. I really liked that it didn't say that. It just left it up to you. And I found myself in Spec Ops thinking, wait, can I actually just not do something at this point and continue?
Yep.
And it shouldn't be like that. That should be every game. That should be everything. We should be able to think that.
And I love that it didn't drop the ball at the end, and the ending isn't decided by the choices you've made, but your reflection on what's happened makes your decision. So at the end, you've kind of got a couple of options. Again, it doesn't come up saying pick this one. You've got a few choice of actions, and afterwards, I kind of read about it and found out that you can actually extend some of those by further actions, and it's just so clever in the way it does it. But the way that your personal reaction to finding out what the whole game's about then will reflect your personal choice and how you play out the ending of the game, rather than just, oh, this is what you've done in the game so far, so you get this ending, because you didn't pick this, and this up on the way. Yeah. Everyone gets the same choices at the end, but how you react is going to be completely dependent on your kind of reaction to what's just come before.
Definitely, yeah. So it's very interesting discussions about games being used as storytelling medium, the choice versus lack of choice. Yeah, it's quite cool. But pulling away from that a little bit into a completely different type of game, I want to talk about Supreme Commander 2. Not many narrative choices in this game.
Just win.
I've got to say, just win. Build your base, blow robots up, and win. I mean, video games can be so many different things, mm-hmm. but this is one of the things I love about it. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's such a diverse medium. But this kind of strategy game, grand scale strategy game, is my kind of, I don't know, pure entertainment experience. I'm not thinking about what it's telling me
it's
about
your Pacific
life or the
Rim.
Universe of the world. It's my Pacific Rim. Yeah. To be honest, I think viewing Pacific Rim made me want to get to Supreme Commander 2 because it has equally massive robots and ridiculous battles. But yeah, strategy game made very much in the style of Total Annihilation. Do you remember Total Annihilation?
I never played it, but I do recall it.
Classic RTS, gas-powered games made game.
They're not around anymore, are they?
They're not anymore. No, I don't believe so. I'm not entirely sure. I think lots of the guys who did work there have now gone on to make Planetary Annihilation.
Which is kind of the future of this franchise.
So you can track the lineage of this RTS. It's not all in the same franchise. They're not all called the same things. But if you're going to track the lineage of it, it's Total Annihilation, the original Supreme Commander, and then Supreme Commander 2, and then Planetary Annihilation is the game being made at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it was actually probably watching Pacific Rim and hearing about Planetary Annihilation that made me want to go back and play some more Supreme Commander 2. So yeah, I've purely just been playing multiplayer. It's a classic RTS.
How's it held up?
Mine resources. I really enjoy it. Mm-hmm. I think it's that kind of experience where I enjoy it because I know what I'm doing. I could instantly jump into it and play against other people straight away and hold my own. So. Mm-hmm. I kind of enjoy it from that competitive edge. I don't necessarily enjoy something like Call of Duty, Twitch-based things like that. I enjoy these grander scale strategy games for multiplayer games. Yeah, but it's really, I've been having some fun matches. It's really held up quite well, I think, Supreme Commander 2. I think the original Supreme Commander was too ambitious for its times, kind of like Crysis in that sense where it kind of went ridiculous scale, absolutely huge scale, thousands and thousands of machines on the battlefield at once interacting, and my PC when I got it back in the day couldn't run it.
Mm.
like Steam came out the back of it when I tried to run it, but now I've got something more powerful and modern that I can actually run these games. So I've been having some fun multiplayer matches with Supreme Commander 2. It's kind of interesting. It's got three different factions. It's got, I can't remember the names of them, but they're slightly different in the way they play. Not as different as they, as say the factions in StarCraft.
Yeah.
But they are slightly different in a sense. So I always enjoy it when things are slightly different. When you've got a multiplayer game where the sides or the factions are slightly different and they play differently. I always think that's quite entertaining and try and master each one. I've been trying to go around each of the different factions and trying to learn how to play as them, because normally, like when I used to play Supreme Commander, I always stuck as one faction and mastered them. So
is the online community still there?
There's a very small amount. I think there's a very small amount of dedicated players. I mean, I've just been invited to someone's Supreme Commander group on Steam, because there's that. Every time I go on, there's probably about 500 people online playing it.
Okay.
So there's like a small dedicated community of people are interested. Yeah.
I mean, how many people do you get in a game? Is it up to four?
It's up to eight. So you have four on a side. So it's big scale strategy. Up to eight players, but you can play one on one if you want on any map. Yeah, it's really good. Enjoying it.
It reminds me of the last time I played anything like that would be End of Nations, which I played 2 years ago. I don't think that's actually officially out yet. I think it might still be in beta, which is a free-to-play one. And then a long time ago, I can't remember the name. It was a kind of RTS. I don't think you had bases. Or did you? And it was kind of a fantasy RTS. And I remember there's kind of a King of the Hill mode. And I'm sure it was like one race was dwarfs, and there was kind of some like undead ones, but there's something called Blights or something where there's just like big fat bloated things that blew up. I can't remember what it was called. It's going to wind me up now.
Fantasy one sounds like Warcraft or something.
It wasn't that. I can't remember what it was called. It was a long time ago. But that was quite big when it came out. I don't know what happened to it. But no, I haven't played an RTS, which is why one of the games I picked up in the Steam sale, because it's one of the flash sales, 75% off, was Rome, Total War. So there was a, I can't remember, it might have been the Total, like, Gold Edition package. But yeah, just whacked all the settings up to full, so it doesn't look horribly pixelated. Some of the controls are, I'm trying to get, it seems to want me to play on the right-hand side of the keyboard and use the mouse, so I need to reconfigure that. But no, I just played through the tutorial and stuff, and it was, it's like you said, I've played a lot of first-person shooters. I mean, I used to be able to, it got to the point of like doing 14-hour stretch on Time Splitters 2, being able to complete the first level of Doom blindfolded, all sorts of stuff. Man. But now I think maybe I'm just getting old, but I want to kind of mix that up more, and playing something like this where I can just pause the game or take time, slow the speed down in-game, think a bit more on that kind of broader level.
Longer play periods and more thought out strategy. You have to think about things, where things go and things like that. Not necessarily Twitch gameplay.
And it's just definitely because I've come back to PC gaming this year. Just because generally consoles have obviously run in their end of the cycle now. And they're kind of simmering down, as we've seen the release schedule since April or something. It's been pretty skimpy. They've only got one thing left to talk about. And if you want to do anything else first.
I haven't been playing anything else recently, so that's me, Spent. I need to play, I got Civ 5, Civilization 5, and I actually got Torchlight 2 as well on Steam.
Do you want to co-op that?
Yeah, sure.
I think we should, because I've only played it a bit, but yeah, we could do some of that. Maybe try and finally get this streaming thing sorted for the site. So if you're listening, you might have a video by this time, but I doubt it. We'll work on it.
Of me and Shane fumbling through Torchlight
2. Yeah. So the last thing I'm going to talk about is a preview build for Saints Row 4. Which was it seemed to be the full game. It probably didn't have the ending. I mean, I played it for about two and a half hours.
Yeah.
And it is a lot of fun.
So I mean, I've never played a full Saints Row game all the way through. I've played on a friend's Xbox a little bit, so I know generally what it feels like, but I've never properly played a Saints Row game before.
So for those,
you would recommend it?
Yeah, for those that have, at the moment it seems to be sitting very well between 2 and 3. So 3 was ridiculous and over the top. But it lacks some of the cohesive quality that the second one had. So it originally started as, say, it started as a GTA clone, really. It tried to be a bit quirky and different, and it's fair enough. It was fine enough as kind of an alternative. But the second one is where they really started to find their own stride and play on the notion that this is a video game, we can do whatever we want. And so this mission started getting more ludicrous, and the kind of conversations and the way that, and it kind of took the customization of the character from the first one. So you make your own character, kind of that old kind of wrestling fashion where you can pick stupid clothes or do whatever you want. And they have like three different voices, three male, three female, and there's kind of like a over-the-top Cockney voiceover, which is brilliant. So I always use that.
Michael Caine.
Yeah, it's like that. And just some of the stuff he says is absolutely brilliant. But in the new one, it's fast-forwarded a bit. The Saints have been... In the third one, the Saints are superstars, and now they are... Well, you are the president of the United States of America. And it's turned the parody thing up to about 11. So there's a part where you're walking down... strutting down towards kind of giving a speech as the president, and people come over these clipboards and say, like, do you want to end world hunger or end cancer? And it comes with, like, press left or right of, like, a blue and a red, like, paragon thing, and kind of mimics the sound and stuff like
Mass
that.
Mass Effect.
Yeah. There's a much better Mass Effect joke earlier on in the game. Right, it's right at the beginning. I'm not going to go too much into it, the rest of
Is
them.
It? All right.
But
I
basically,
would
you've
guess
got,
it
you've,
would be...
You've got right, a helmet on. And you go to talk to the rest of your crew in that fashion, but the mic's broke on the helmet, so you can't. So the whole first part of the game you play in is like no voice communication from his point of view. It plays much tighter. So the gunplay in it works really well. It's kind of got the arcade driving style. And essentially then it goes... I mean, this is the general plot, so it's not a spoiler. It happens straight at the beginning. The aliens then come down and invade the US. And you are transported, kidnapped, and imprisoned in a virtual world. Mm. So you're in a video game, in a video game.
Oh, yeah, right.
So you get superpowers. So rather than like stealing a car, calling it, you can just select it digitally. It just appears straight away. Or you can get powers where you can start leaping over buildings.
So it's got an explanation for all of the ridiculous things in the game.
So it just and it just plays on that. So it's not like, what do you want to do? You want to jump into this building? That's fine.
Yeah.
Shoot these massive. You just get massive guns straight away. But it doesn't do it in a way that feels cheap or gets boring after 5 minutes. And it works really well. It's similar to, I guess, the original Crackdown on the Xbox. I remember that being quite similar in the way you could just bound around the city. But it mixes those bits. The writing's really strong. There's a lot of funny moments early on in the game. And those continue. So they seem to have hit the nail right on the head, and it's just going to be, looks to be very solid. A lot of fun. Especially, games have been getting quite serious recently, so this is going to be the opposite to that.
So on our scale of games as art, games as entertainment, I think this is fairly well up the games as entertainment side of things.
Oh yeah, it is, yeah. Very self-aware, it's having a lot of fun.
It's quite interesting what you said about the game is obviously it's a video game, but it's set within a video game to try and kind of like explain all the ridiculous things that have been happening in it.
Yeah, so when you pull a woman out of a car and punch her in the face and steal a car, it's just done in a kind of blah blah. It doesn't matter, she's just a computer person. And these
it's
little
not real, it's virtual.
These little computer chip things come out and it makes a joke out of as much as it can.
Yeah. Pretty much. Kind of like, it's a weird thing. It reminds me. This is going to sound strange. It reminds me of Call of Juarez Gunslinger. I was just thinking about this the other day. In Call of Juarez Gunslinger, you've got kind of like an unreliable narrator. So the things, but you're playing through his story as he's telling it. But he's being ridiculous. He's being over the top. He's being overblown. So obviously most games like this are ridiculous or over the top. You play a protagonist and he can mow down thousands and thousands of people and never take that much harm himself. He can survive bullet wounds and gunshots. And it's kind of like in Call of Juarez, the unreliable narrator and the fact that you're playing out what he's saying, not the actual events, kind of explain why it's ridiculous. That gives it a context. It gives it a setting. Mm-hmm. That's like the explanation. Like, it obviously wasn't like that in real life, but you're playing out what the story he's telling, and the story he's telling is ridiculous.
Yeah, it's exaggeration makes it fun and entertaining
to
play.
Yeah, and it's a weird way of kind of like explaining the ridiculousness of video games, but making it make sense.
I wonder
in a real
where
world.
We'll go from here, because clearly developers are at a point now where they know the difficulty.
How stupid, yeah.
Yeah, and it's like, well, do we tone it down? But if we do, then we're going to have to make the game, the atmosphere really engaging or people will get bored. So
yeah, you get to really like The Last of Us then.
It means very self-aware when making a game and thinking, am I just making a 100% kind of entertainment game? Because yeah. if I try and do anything more, then I know that. It's like we said before, Bioshock Infinite was, it's, you know, the thing where you go into like a bin and there's a packet of crisps and you eat it. Or there's just money everywhere. Or you, in games when you're constantly looting people's houses. You're supposed to be a hero and you're running around stealing food and 5p off like the cabinet and stuff like that.
Yeah. But it's a stupid little thing, and it's such a tiny thing, but I kind of appreciate, in a way, I don't know if I should, I appreciate that games, that these designers have gone, look, our game is absolutely ridiculous, the things that you're doing in this game don't make any sense, so we're going to make a story that kind of, like, it makes sense within the context of that story, because you're not playing real world, this isn't real world, this is a story being told, and you're playing the story being told, or this is a video game within a video game, and you're playing in that video game, and that's why it's ridiculous.
There is a maturity to the stupidity of it, which, where, you know, the game's daft and stuff, but the people, it's a good sign of the industry, they know, look, we're getting better to grips now, as the technology progresses, we could do more and more, we realise we can play around with things more, and it allows us just to have fun when we want to. And I'm kind of like, it's interesting, on a side note, that Ubisoft have done like two mid-tier games now. So they've done Blood Dragon and this.
Okay.
And they're both kind of on, if you think about it, they're mid-tier digital games, aren't they? Where
they've taken
a pre-existing engine, given it to a small team and said, you know, do what you want with it, run wild for 6 months and have fun. And both of them have been really well received. Mm. I'm wondering if more people will start doing that.
I think we'll see that. I mean, we talked about this last time, didn't we? I think we'll see... game development, like kind of like splinter in terms of budgets and scale of development. I think you'll, like, at the moment, it very much seems to be, and classically, commonly, it's been the high end, and now the low end's creeped in with the independent developers. So you've got the real, real big budget AAA development, and then you've got small scale independent developers. But you're seeing the middle ground there, the in between those areas, starting to flesh out at the moment. You're seeing more developers try things and maybe release something as a £15 downloadable game, £10 downloadable game. I think next generation you'll definitely see that. That'll be the norm. People will kind of like scale their game, like, oh, I want to make a mid-tier experience or slightly mid to high. It won't just be high or low.
It makes sense when you've got, it gives room for more creative ideas because you are, for example, you build an engine and you spend 4 years on a game. You make it look great, but towards the end of it, once the engine's settled, you have a small side team say, right, build, you know, along with us, just run with it, build your own game. You've got, it's all the same assets and stuff, reskin it, do your own story, do what you need. Yeah. You've got 6 months, and then we'll release it 6 months later after this, and we can start making extra additional money on, rather than just dumping the engine and starting again. It's an extra income source that can support that kind of ultra high tier, as you know, as game development gets into the $100 million, it starts getting daft. You need that extra layer. It's like in cinemas and stuff where you'll have like Sony Pictures and they'll release the largest big budget thing ever, but you'll have all these other things and they kind of all exist. They both support each other. The smaller stuff gets made because of the big budget sells, but that also keeps that afloat at the same time.
And that's how it should be, and I'm really hoping, I get the impression that Sony's going to push for that in next generation. I really hope that's what they do. They support all tiers of game development. It's not just the big end, and they support the lower tiers as well, and really give them an area and a marketplace and a place where they can really sell themselves. Because that's what it should be. It should be such a variety of experience. I mean, one of the most important things to any medium is variation, and that they're experimenting and trying different things and new things. I mean, there's nothing wrong with a game like Saints Row, a game like Supreme Commander, games that are very much made in the mold of old games, but bigger and fancier and flashier. There's nothing wrong with that. That's fine. That's entertainment. There's nothing wrong with that, but you need to have these different experiences as well. They need to exist to test the boundaries of the medium and expand it. Okay, so I think we've talked about a lot of different games as well. I think we probably talked about that whole spectrum of games from entertainment to art form as well on this podcast. Anything else you want to talk about, Shane?
I think that'll do for now.
Yeah, okay. So that's it for episode 27. If you want to let us know what you think about any of those games or what you've been playing, head on over to thunderboltgames.com and check out the forums. Or alternatively, contact us on Twitter @_Thunderbolt or email us at podcast@thunderboltgames.com. From me, it's goodbye. I'm from Shane.
Goodbye.